WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests Michael Gordon and General Bernard Traynor have written a new book called The General's War, which uses the Gulf War as a case study of American warfare in the 90s. Gordon is defense correspondent for the New York Times. Traynor is a retired three-star Marine Corps general, was military analyst for ABC News during the Gulf War, and now directs the national security programs at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. The Gulf War ended swiftly with remarkably few American casualties, but by some standards it was an incomplete success. Half of the Iraqi Republican Guards got away. Saddam Hussein still rules Iraq. And last October, American units were ordered back to the Gulf to prevent a possible second Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. During the war, the American public was given the impression of a smoothly coordinated military effort. I asked Traynor and Gordon what they see differently about the war now. First, we'll hear Michael Gordon.
One thing that really struck me personally when we gained access to the documents after the war and to many of the participants was the extent to which each of the individual services fought their own war. The Air Force fought its launched its strategic bombing campaign. The Army fought the sort of war it would have fought had it taken on the Russians in Europe. The Marines carried out their attack and their expeditionary tradition. And one thing I was struck by was really how a little interaction there was among the services and how Schwarzkopf and General Powell really failed to pull it all together. I think this was not at all apparent during the war. First of all, there was so much going on. Second of all, we knew so little about how the war plan was put together.
General, what's the thing that you feel you see differently now as a result of the research?
Well, the incredible influence of Colin Powell. At the time, you know, we knew he was the principal advisor to the president and the Secretary of Defense, but at the time, I don't think we had any understanding of the amount of clout that he actually had. Now, by law, the Secretary of Defense and the president deal directly with the field commander, and Powell is supposed to be just an advisor. He is not, what they say in the military, in the chain of command. But for all practical purposes, he was not only in the chain of command, but he orchestrated the political and military events that unfolded in the war. That was the first thing that came as an enormous surprise. And the second one was the relative ineffectiveness of Norman Schwarzkopf, who was big, bluff, and hardy, but really turned out to be an individual who pretty much acquiesced to whatever Powell wanted. And in addition to that, he really didn't exercise strong leadership over the various components that made up the coalition. He gets full marks in terms of keeping the disparate coalition together, but in terms of harmonizing the efforts of his own U.S. services, much less the coalition itself, I think he has to be faulted for that.
Well, you've both mentioned that the services didn't seem to be coordinated. Michael Gordon, you said each service fought its own war. Can you give us an example of where the services were at odds?
Well, there are a couple of very prominent examples that I could cite, and I'm sure General Traynor can expand on easily. But first off, the Air Force and the Army virtually fought their own war between themselves throughout the entire planning and execution of the campaign. The Air Force thought the primary purpose of their bombers was to take the war to the enemy heartland, to Baghdad, to basically try to win the war by decapitating and destroying Saddam Hussein's government. The Army never thought that was possible and wanted the Air Force essentially to be its servant and to, quote, prepare the battlefield, i.e., attack the Iraqi forces directly in front of the Army. And that was a very serious kind of issue throughout the entire campaign. Then there was another disconnect between a lot of the Army and Marine planning. When it came to the war, the Marines were far more confident in their ability to take on the Iraqis than the Army, and this really threw, I think, a monkey wrench into the overall plan.
Well, General Traynor, you mentioned the influence of Colin Powell in the war, a surprising amount of influence. You're right that he actually cautioned against relying on air power. What direction do you think Powell took the war in?
Well, Powell from the start could be classified as a reluctant warrior. And I don't fault him entirely for that. I mean, he was a victim of the Vietnamese War, and his thinking was influenced greatly by the inconclusiveness and the lack of objective in the Vietnam War and the useless loss of life and so forth. And he took the position, look, if you're going to use U.S. military forces, they shouldn't be the plaything of politicians. There should be clear objectives and so forth, and if you're going to do it decisively with massive force and do it with low casualties. This is the sort of thinking that he brought to his maturity as a result of Vietnam. But in effect, it made him a reluctant warrior right from the start and right to the end of the war.
Michael Gordon, do you have a critique of General Schwarzkopf's handling of the war?
Part of the problem with Schwarzkopf is he has, his nickname is Stormin' Norman. And indeed, he was a person who was prone to tirades. He used to upbraid his subordinates. The people who knew him well in CENTCOM, many of them didn't particularly like to work for him because he was very hard on them. But for all of his bluster and as angry as he could be at times, he really was, not a very strong figure. I think the end of the war provides a very revealing insight into Schwarzkopf. Basically, the impetus to begin thinking about the end of the war came from Colin Powell and a series of phone calls. We know this because we talked to Schwarzkopf for about 8 hours one day in Tampa, and we've also talked to Powell. And Schwarzkopf pretty much gets the drift of what that Washington wants to begin thinking about the end of the war, and he begins to focus on it as well. Finally, the question is put to him, and he more or less acquiesces in the end of the war. After the decision is made, Schwarzkopf's deputy, General Cal Waller, is informed that the Bush administration has decided to call a ceasefire. And Waller is irate, and he says things you can't say on the radio, but he says, well, how could you do that? You know, what is going on there? And at that point, Schwarzkopf says to him, well, 100 hours, says sarcastically, has a nice ring. And then Waller says, well, wait a second, you can't do this. This is a bad decision. And then Schwarzkopf says to Waller, then you go argue with them. And you have the sense from that of a man who is likes to parade on the public stage and create the image of a very strong commander-in-chief, but when it comes down to it, was not about to stand up to Washington on something that he thought Washington wanted. And it was pretty much incumbent on Schwarzkopf at that juncture not to yield to Powell and his political judgment about how to end the war, but to come up with a good picture of what was happening on a battlefield, and if he didn't have one, put off the decision to end the war and maybe take a stand and say, well, General Powell, if they want to end the war, I'll go along with it, but I'm going to give my best assessment to the president that we haven't quite done the job.
You said that General Schwarzkopf said to General Waller, well, if you don't want to end the war this early, mm-hmm. you go argue with them mm-hmm. in Washington. Do you have any other indication that Schwarzkopf was unwilling or unable to stand up to Washington?
Well, General Schwarzkopf had some admirable qualities. He was effective with the Arabs. But basically, as we point out in the book, General Schwarzkopf was pretty much a company man. He was an army general of no unique accomplishment who was given authority over the Central Command precisely because the Pentagon did not expect a shooting war in the Middle East. And he had done well by the system. He had gotten 4 stars by the system. But basically, he was not that original a military thinker. He was not a Patton-esque figure. He was not the kind of guy who would get out there and devise his own war plan and tell if Washington didn't like it, well, you know, the hell with it. And, you know, if you look at the plans that were developed by his command, much of it came from Washington. It came from experts in the Air Force and the Pentagon. It came from of a whole variety of sources, including some civilians. And one's really struck by the fact that Schwarzkopf really did not originate much of his own war plan. He was dependent on Washington for a lot of military advice, and he was well aware of that.
My guests are the co-authors of The General's War. Michael Gordon is Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times. General Bernard Traynor directs the national security programs at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Michael Gordon and General Bernard Traynor, co-authors of The General's War, the inside story of the conflict in the Gulf. One of the things you look at in your book is how well did the military build up during the Reagan years, serve the military during the Gulf War. I'd like to bring that story up to the present. I mean, the funding for the military is being debated now. Looking at what happened during the Gulf War, what direction do you think the military needs to head in terms of what it should be spending money on now?
Well, the military, of course, will always say that they need more. This is a natural thing. Even during the period of the Reagan buildup, they were always asking for more. But I think the important thing was the U.S. military made a basic decision some years ago when they were facing the Soviet Union's in the Cold War, that they would go to offset Soviet strength in numbers, that we would go the high-tech route, get high-technology equipment that would offset their numbers. And number two, to have a well-trained, well-educated military force. And those were two very effective investments. The military that went down to the Gulf was equipped with this terrific equipment. Some of these things that you saw on television, which were so impressive, worked. They worked as advertised. Sometimes they worked better than advertised. And the troops that fought down there were very high quality, very well trained in realistic training, and it paid off.
One point I might add to that, Terry, is that while it certainly surprised me as a journalist that the high-tech weapons worked to any reasonable expectation of their performance. You know, we tend to look at these weapons and, you know, certainly journalists and look for exposés about how they fell short, and I've written a few of those myself. But we did turn up one area of neglect, which I would call the for want of a nail phenomenon, which is for all the money that was spent in the Reagan military buildup, they sure didn't spend enough on a lot of the kind of common items that turned out to be needed in the war. Example, mine-clearing equipment so that the Marines could attack into the Iraqi defenses to get the mine-clearing equipment they needed, which is very basic equipment, plows that push aside mines. The Marines had to launch a secret program to get it from the Israelis, who, as we know, were not a member of this coalition. And it had to be brought in surreptitiously into Saudi Arabia, painted with Marine Corps markings so as not to offend the Arabs. That's one example. Radios. The American pilots who were shot down over Iraq didn't have radios that were effectively encrypted, meaning they could talk in code and their location could not be located by any Iraqis who intercepted those communications. And as a result, American pilots were captured during the war and spent a lot of time in prisons in Baghdad. This is not sophisticated equipment. It's basic equipment. During the Reagan buildup, there was too many billions of dollars for stealth bombers and MX missiles and not enough for some of this more basic equipment that the United States needs when they fight a third world adversary.
Michael, what did you learn from your research about the behind-the-scenes debate about whether to target Saddam Hussein during the war?
Well, as a journalist, I went to all the briefings at the Pentagon and elsewhere where we were told that Saddam Hussein was not a target and that no specific effort was being made to kill him. And that turned out not to be the case. Saddam Hussein was a target. He was a target of opportunity. Certainly, the people who directed the air war, if they got intelligence, sometimes imperfect intelligence, that Saddam Hussein was operating from a van somewhere in the Iraqi desert, they made specific orders, bomb that van on an urgent basis. In fact, we got hold of a formerly classified Air Force oral history where one of the officers in the Air Force Command talks very bluntly about this. He said, well, we certainly didn't try to assassinate him, but we did try to kill him. And you recall that there is a ban on assassination, so what the military wasn't doing, they weren't assassinating a foreign leader, they were trying to kill the commander-in-chief of an enemy army, which would be legal under American law.
Do you think there's a lot of second-guessing now among the people who led the Gulf War about how they handled Saddam Hussein?
I think in some of my conversations, certainly the Bush administration is very defensive about how it ended the war. There was a widespread view within the Bush administration that Saddam Hussein would fall within 6 months of the end of the war. And I was told that by the most senior officials. In fact, I made a few bets on that issue. But I think if some of them are kind of let their hair down, I think they do say sometimes, gee, you know, if we had known that half the Republican Guard was going to get away, I don't think we necessarily would have ended the war the way we did. That's something they tell you in private. In public, I think they'll defend it to the end of time. But in private, I think you do sense, when they're being honest with themselves, feeling that if they had really realized the extent to which the Iraqis were going to escape and they could do it over again, they would do it somewhat differently.
General, I'm sure a lot of our listeners remember you from when you were giving on-air analysis for ABC TV during the Gulf War. Did you feel at odds with yourself in that role during the war? Because on the one hand, you're a retired military man. You probably know what it's like to fight, and maybe you didn't want a lot of information to get out at that point. But here you were in the function of the press, interpreting the war for the public and trying to look ahead and guess what was going to happen.
No, I wasn't.
You weren't at odds with yourself?
No.
Or you weren't trying to guess what
happened? And I was not trying to guess what happened. Mm-hmm. I took the position right from the outset, and this was my arrangement with ABC, that I would take the arcane data that was coming in, this military data, and I would translate it into something that was understandable to the viewership. But I said I would not try to second-guess the field commander or try to play field marshal. And I've gone over all of the tapes of ABC and all the other interviews I had during the war to make sure that I did not violate that credo, and I'm very comfortable that I did not.
But do you feel like you're doing that now, that you're second-guessing everybody who
well,
led the war?
Well, I'm not second-guessing. This can be a little bit like Monday morning quarterbacking, but there isn't a football coach in the world that doesn't look at the game tape and see the performance of the team to evaluate it and see what went right, what went wrong, so that it could be corrected for the future. And really, that's what Michael and I are trying to do, is to analyze this sort of thing in terms of what effect that they have on military thinking and operations in the future.
Michael, is it interesting for you to be a part of the writing or rewriting of the history of the Gulf War? You know, Schwarzkopf has his book. A lot of people have been writing books, and all the players are giving their point of view, aside from a few who don't really like to talk about it at all. But the history of the Gulf War is very much up for grabs right now, the meaning of the Gulf War.
Well, I think so. I think there are a lot of books about the Gulf War. There are not very many good books about the Gulf War. And I've read almost all of them. There are only a handful of decent books about the Gulf War. And that has to do with the nature of American society, where a big event happens and then everybody moves on, whether it's to O.J. Simpson or Tonya Harding or Chechnya, and people tend not to look back that much. And I think partly it's because it's easy to sort of, it's one thing to write about so-called disclosures about what happened with the Gulf War. It's an entirely different challenge to try to figure out what it all means. And when General Traynor and I worked for these 3 years to put this book together, more than 3 years, the hardest part of it wasn't coming up with scoops, which we did come up with. It was trying to resolve in our own minds. So what really happened here? We know that half the Republican Guard got away. Why did that happen? That's been the mystery of the Gulf War. Different people answer it in different ways. We think we've come up with a cogent, persuasive analysis, but which puts the finger of blame a little bit on, more than a little bit, on General Powell. But I'm told that he may respond to argument in his forthcoming book.
Why do you point to Powell as being largely responsible for why the Republican Guard got away?
Because he for a variety of reasons that we've gone over a little bit here, but because Powell, number one, was the primary military figure in this conflict, not Schwarzkopf. I think everything that Schwarzkopf did, every step, every plan, air war plan, ground war plan, everything that General Schwarzkopf put together had to be briefed to General Powell and pass muster with General Powell, or it was not the plan. So I think to the extent that there were disconnects within the strategy, ultimately that has to be laid at General Powell's doorstep. I think also General Powell, because of his political intuitions, which turned out to be wrong, that there would be a huge backlash against the United States in the Middle East if the war was carried on too long, supported a premature end to the war, which deprived the American military of its full victory. And we are measuring the American military by their standard, their goal, which was destroy the Republican Guard. We're not saying they should have gone to Baghdad, although that's a separate issue. They set out to destroy the Republican Guard, and they didn't do it because of General Powell's political intuition that the war needed to be brought to a close to avoid a political backlash against American forces and to avoid tainting the image of the American military. And in the final, in the very end also, after the fighting was over, there was still an opportunity to squeeze the Iraqis. We didn't have to leave southern Iraq in a matter of weeks. The American forces were sitting on top of Iraq's oil fields. They could have sat in there for months as we squeezed the Iraqis and tried to get what we wanted from them. That was the view of, in fact, General McCaffrey was one of the very successful commanders in the Gulf who led the 24th Mechanized Division, told me, he said, I couldn't understand why we're leaving so soon. We held all the cards. But General Powell and also General Schwarzkopf wanted American forces out and wanted them out fast because they were afraid of becoming tied into the situation, getting ensnared there. It was their Vietnam experience speaking to them. But this was not Vietnam. This was the Middle East. And in the Middle East, when you have an advantage like that, and when you've demonized a man like Saddam Hussein, you need to press the advantage home.
Michael Gordon and General Bernard Traynor are co-authors of The General's War, the inside story of the conflict in the Gulf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.